very much, Annette, for inviting me, and thank you all for coming on this rainy day. And I've enjoyed my visit here very much. I'd like to keep it informal. I have actually probably too many slides to go through, but you know we'll go through them. And I will. This is my website here, and I'll post the PowerPoint presentation on that website. And so some of the slides I'll probably speed through, but they'll be there for you know if you are interested. And on that website, there's also reprints. I guess as a government employee, I can't sign away copyright. So one of the advantages of that is I can actually post reprints on my website without violating anybody's copyright things. And I have a lot of reprints there. And BRBRA tool software is there. And I'll mention something about we're going to be talking about sort of targeted clinical trial designs, and we've actually tried to put some software, some web-based software for being able to get sample size calculations for some of these designs on the website so you can sort of try them out for yourself in the design sort of situation that you might be considering to see whether there are efficiency gains or what the efficiency gains might be. Some years ago, I developed these two-stage phase two designs that became very popular. And actually, we have on that website is an interactive program that provides those two-stage phase two designs also. I mean, obviously, genomics can influence clinical trials in a variety of ways, and I'm not going to be talking about all of the ways. Probably the most important ways is to sort of lead the way to understand diseases better and thereby to develop more effective treatments for the diseases. But also for the treatments that are to be evaluated, genomics has a role, I think, both for early clinical trial development, phase 1-2 development, and for the way we do phase three or pivotal trials, particularly with regard to selection of patient populations to be studied and the designs we use for studying those patient populations. I would want to try to clarify. I'm going to be using the term, I guess, on and off biomarker, or maybe using it somewhat, and so I like to try to clarify two different uses of this term, because they're really very different uses. One is sort of biomarker as a surrogate endpoint, something you measure before treatment and then maybe during and after treatment, that as the treatment progresses, it goes up, as the treatment regresses, it goes down, and you can sort of try to use to track the progress of the disease and the response to treatment. Can you see okay there? Okay. And the other is a really totally different use of the term biomarker, and that is sort of as a predictive classifier, something you just measure pre-treatment-wise that enables you to somehow characterize the patient's disease or the patient's genetics, and thereby potentially then to use in selecting treatment for that patient. These are very different kinds of uses of biomarkers, and sort of it becomes particularly important because when you start talking about what constitutes validation of a biomarker, I think validation only has meaning in terms of the intended use of that biomarker, and since the intended use and these two kinds of things are totally different, validation is totally different. Surrogate endpoints, I think, it's extremely difficult to sort of properly validate a biomarker as a surrogate endpoint of clinical benefit, because ultimately what it really takes is sort of randomized clinical trials in which you measure real clinical benefit and then you measure this candidate biomarker and you try to show that you get concordant results with regard to clinical benefit and biomarker. And that's a big job to do. And so to really think you're going to use a biomarker as an alternative to clinical benefit in a pivotal trial, in some cases, is quite unrealistic. However, biomarkers can be very useful in phase one and phase two studies and need not be validated as surrogates of clinical benefit. They may just be measures of whether your drug is sort of hitting its target. Whether that results in clinical benefit may be a different issue, but you're not going to make strong claims about the drug based on the phase one and phase two studies. The purpose of the studies pretty much is to help you optimize the use of the drug, the doses you'll use it at, what kind of patients you will target, and those kinds of things. And so you don't need a validated biomarker in some officially validated sense for those purposes. You can also use unvalidated biomarkers sort of for futility analysis in pivotal trials. Like, in other words, you could say, well, I can do an early interim analysis of a pivotal trial with regard to some biomarker, unvalidated surrogate endpoint, and if I'm not having a treatment effect with regard to that biomarker, then I'll stop the study early, won't go to a large sample size, won't go to long follow-up. Otherwise, I'll continue the study and to evaluate it with really the full sample size and follow-up I need to measure clinical benefit. Mostly what I'm going to be talking about, though, are not surrogate endpoints, but rather predictive classifiers. And most cancer treatments, for example, and it may be true for other diseases, really benefit only a minority of the patients to whom they're administered. And I think that's particularly true for sort of new generations of molecularly targeted cancer drugs. And being able to predict, even if imperfectly, which patients are most likely to benefit from a given drug would have lots of potential benefits both to patients, to the clinical development process, and ultimately to societal medical costs by enhancing the likelihood that patients who get treated with potentially expensive drugs actually benefit from those treatments. Oncology really needs predictive markers, that is, that help you predict whether a given treatment is going to be of benefit, not general prognostic factors. There are many prognostic factor studies that are done with a convenience sample of patients. The patient populations are heterogeneous with regard to what kind of treatments the patients got, and even with regard to stage. And so those kinds of studies, which I think are the majority of studies in cancer, are very difficult to interpret in terms of a therapeutically relevant conclusions about which treatments are likely to benefit who. I don't want to go through it in detail, but this was a citation of a paper of all of the 939 articles about prognostic factors in breast cancer over 20 years, and yet current practice guidelines only call for the measurement of three: estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2 expression in tumors. So a lot of the prognostic factor studies are not sort of focused enough to be helpful in treatment selection. Now, targeted clinical trials, in the sense of targeting selected patients to be included in the trials, can be much more efficient than untargeted trials if we know who to target. And in new drug development, I guess I see the role of a predictive classifier of the disease is to really select a target population for treatment. And the focus should then be on evaluating the new drug in a population defined by this predictive classifier, not on validating the classifier in some other sense. And so one very simple and straightforward kind of a developmental strategy for a new treatment is to sort of first develop some sort of classifier that you think identifies patients who are likely to benefit from this new drug or this new treatment, and then develop a reproducible assay for measuring that classifier, and I'm thinking of it as sort of a binary classifier, and then use that classifier to restrict eligibility in a prospectively planned randomized clinical trial for evaluating that new drug or that new treatment versus whatever is the appropriate control, and to try to demonstrate that the new drug is effective in this prospectively defined set of patients. So this is just sort of representing that graphically. And we published a couple of papers related to that sort of simple approach, trying to evaluate the relative efficiency of that approach with regard to the number of randomized patients needed and the number of patients that you need to screen with your classifier assay, comparing this sort of targeted approach where you select patients based on some classifier to sort of an untargeted, more traditional approach where you don't try to select patients, and to try to do that comparison as a function of sort of the performance characteristics of your classifier. In other words, not assuming that your classifier is positive, but is perfect, but you know, assuming that for the classifier positive patients, you have still some who are better with the new treatment than the control, and some in a certain proportion that don't do better with the new. So there's a treatment effect in the classifier positive patients. There's a treatment effect in the classifier negative patients. And there's a certain prevalence of the classifier positive patients, and trying to evaluate efficiency in those kind of terms. And I think I won't have time to go through it in detail, but you can actually make approximations. You know, actually the papers try to evaluate the efficiency without making real approximations, but you can do approximations that sort of show the structure of the problem with sort of a binary outcome. One of those papers dealt with a binary outcome, the other dealt with sort of a continuous outcome, and we have actually software on the website that also does this sort of comparative analysis with a time-to-event outcome, like a survival or disease-free survival outcome. But with a simple binary outcome, you can get sort of a relationship between the ratio of number of patients needed to randomize to get a fixed power for a fixed treatment effect if you do an untargeted trial versus a targeted trial. And I won't go through it in detail. I do want to point out that, for example, if you this first column is the proportion of patients that are classifier positive, that is, are considered more likely to benefit from the new treatment versus the old treatment. And the second column gives the sort of ratio of number of randomized patients needed in the case where you assume that there's no treatment effect, there's no treatment benefit of the new treatment to your marker negative patients. Something like a perfect assay, really, almost perfect, at least with perfect specificity. And the last column is sort of the ratio of number of randomized patients for the setting where the treatment effect for marker for classifier negative patients is assumed to be half as great as it is for classifier positive patients. And in all cases, this ratio of number of randomized patients is greater than one, so there's an efficiency in terms of number of patients required to randomize in using the targeted design. In some cases, particularly if the proportion of patients who are classifier positive is relatively small, then there's a great advantage in terms of number of randomized patients to using the targeted design. The reason being, if you use an untargeted design and the proportion of sensitive patients is small, then the overall treatment effect is going to be diluted, and so the overall treatment effect will be very small. And so the benefit is greatest for the as the proportion of classifier positive patients gets smaller. And you can look at the same kind of thing in terms of not number of randomized patients, but the number of the ratio of the number of patients you have to screen. Now, with the untargeted design, the number you have to screen is the same as the number randomized. But with the targeted design, you may have to screen, of course, a lot more patients to find a certain number who are classifier positive. And so in some cases, actually, for example, in this last column, again, corresponds to the situation where the treatment effect for classifier negative patients is half as great as for classifier positive patients under this alternative hypothesis. So the fact that these ratios are less than one indicates that, well, with the targeted design, you actually have to screen more patients than with the untargeted design. But as shown on the previous slide, the number you have to randomize is less. So there are various considerations in terms of whether you use this kind of design or not. And the statistics in medicine paper that I cited goes into more detail in terms of the effect of sensitivity and specificity with continuous endpoint. And I won't go into those here. One example was Herceptin, where it was actually quite a poor immunohistochemistry assay to define those patients who expressed the HER2 receptor in metastatic breast cancer. And the pivotal trial was done using that assay to select patients. And even though the assay wasn't very good, it was good enough to get approval of the drug, and it would have required really much, much larger clinical trials if Genentech had not targeted those studies. And recent results with Herceptin in earlier breast cancer, node-positive breast cancer, where patients are selected for treatment based on a much better assay, an assay based on gene amplification rather than expression of the protein, shows huge treatment benefits, like a 50% reduction in the hazard of disease-free survival and for essentially classifier-positive patients with this treatment. So I think in some cases we have treatments. I mean, the experience a lot in cancer clinical trials is that the treatment effects are small. Well, some cases they may be small because there is actually a subset of patients who benefit substantially, but unless you can sort of identify those patients beforehand, you can't sort of focus on that subset in which you might actually see large treatment effects. This sort of shows an efficiency comparison with regard to disease-free survival, sort of the Herceptin situation where the treatment effect is a 50% reduction in the hazard for the classifier positive patients. In that kind of situation, you only need 74 events to have, I think it's probably 90% power with the two-sided significance of 0.05 to power for that size of a hazard ratio. Whereas if you did the study in unselected patients, you would need many orders of magnitude more events. Exactly how many orders of magnitude would depend somewhat on the prevalence of marker-positive patients. With the HER2 case, about a third of breast cancer patients are HER2 positive. As I mentioned, at that website, this is sort of a screenshot of the website, and under sample size calculation icon, you click on that, and it brings you to three things: either the optimal two-stage design or the program that does the calculations either for a binary endpoint or survival time endpoint. I won't go through the details. Now, a second you won't always have such confidence in your classifier by the time you're doing a phase three trial that you want to just restrict attention to classifier positive patients. And so a second possible design would be you develop some kind of a predictor of patients likely to respond to the new treatment, and then you study both classifier positive and classifier negative patients with a randomized study of treatment versus control, but you structure an analysis plan that takes the classifier into account. And there's various kinds of analysis plans that one could potentially use, of course. I think the key thing is to make sure that the analysis plan is specifically written into the protocol. What you don't want to do, I think, is just to say, well, we will stratify the randomization by the classifier result and leave it at that. That's not an analysis plan. So one kind of analysis plan that I've proposed is you compare the new drug to the control overall for all patients, ignoring the classifier. But the only difference being you use a threshold of significance of 0.04 for that overall comparison rather than the traditional 0.05. And if that result is not significant, if that result is significant, you make a claim of broad effectiveness. If it's not significant, then you do a single subset analysis evaluating the new drug versus the control in classifier positive patients, in which case you restrict, you use a threshold of significance of 0.01 so that your experiment-wise type 1 error is still limited to 0.05, even though now it's sort of divided between potentially two different tests. So the idea here is, yes, you are doing a subset analysis and you're trying to come away from this trial. If you have just significance with that subset, you're trying to come away with something stronger than you usually come away with from a subset analysis. What you usually come away with is saying, oh, well, this is hypothesis generating, and therefore I have to do another trial to test it. So you try to avoid that here in two ways. One, by limiting it to one pre-specified subset, and secondly, by allocating your alpha between your two possible comparisons so as to limit your experiment-wise type 1 error to the 0.05, so that if you don't get an overall treatment effect, but you just get a treatment effect within that subset at the 0.01 level, that you can make a strong claim for treatment effectiveness restricted to that subset of patients.
I'm curious, how do you pick up the significance level?
Why did I allocate it in that way? Obviously, you could allocate it in other ways. I did it here for two reasons. One, there are two kinds of situations you can anticipate. You could think of. You could think of the situation where you think your treatment is going to have a broad benefit, And you just sort of want to build this classifier in this subset and to sort of give you a second chance in case it doesn't have a broad benefit. And so but in the context where you don't want the subset analysis to detract from the overall analysis or to cause you to have to inflate your sample size too much. So if you did it this way, you could say, well, how do I have another, I think the next slide goes into sample size issues, but the idea being doing it this way, you're going from 0.05 to 0.04, so maybe you disinflate your sample size enough to get you your power for 0.04 that you would have normally gotten with 0.05 for the overall analysis. Now, there's a different context, I guess, could be where you think your drug is only going to be effective in the subset. Like if your classifier is really related to the molecular target of the drug, then you would probably think strongly that it's likely that the drug is just going to be effective in that subset. you might do the broad trial anyway, or you might not. But if you do the broad trial, you would want most of the focus to be on the subset, in which case you wouldn't allocate it this way. I think then you might allocate it with most of the alpha being focused on the subset and smaller part on the overall. I'll talk about that other context, I think, in another slide, too.
Okay.
So okay, the other part of it is you could take into if you took into account the correlation structure, then you could get the two alphas, you could get rid of the conservativeness of doing it this way a little bit. I was trying to keep it simple to make the main point that what you want to make sure you do is preserve the overall experiment-wise 0.05. But you're right, by being a little bit smarter about it, you could preserve the experiment-wise 0.05 and still have a somewhat better alphas.
So what if both are positive?
The idea here, you know, like I say, there are lots of other analysis plans, but what I was proposing for this analysis plan was that you actually would only do the second analysis if the first one was negative. This was oriented to the fact that most commercial sponsors would rather have a broad indication than a narrow approval. You know, this would be a controversial analysis plan. You could say, well, even if it's positive, somebody's going to want to look at the effect separately in those two subsets anyway. And that's probably true. So this has never actually been... One would have to propose this and talk to the FDA and see if that were accepted. But so the purpose of the trial is to evaluate the treatment versus the control overall and in a predefined subset. I guess the point I want to make is that the purpose of the trial is not to reevaluate, is not to refine or improve or enhance the classifier. Because this is actually different than what most people do. Most people, I mean, a lot of, right now when people are using classifiers, particularly if these are multi-component gene expression-based classifiers, they're thinking of the trial as an opportunity to get more data to play around with getting a better classifier. Well, if you do that, now you're back in needing another trial to evaluate that new classifier. So the idea is to prospectively use the classifier to prospectively specify a very clear analysis plan and then evaluate your treatment in those subsets, not to refine your classifier. So various approaches to sample size planning, sort of related to the various sort of contexts in which you might do this. One is, as I mentioned before, size the trial to have, say, 90% power for detecting the usual treatment effect at a significance level, 0.04. In other words, you say, well, okay, we have a time-to-event endpoint, and we normally don't expect a reduction in the hazard of the time-to-event endpoint to be greater than 25%. And so we want 90% power from the overall analysis to detect a 25% reduction in the hazard at a 0.04 significance level. So that requires us to boost up the sample size a little bit to what we might have used if we hadn't played with the classifier at all. Or a different approach might be size the trial for standard power for detecting treatment effect in a subset. In other words, if we do it that way, well, what do we get for the sub? We're saying, well, we're not going to worry about what our power will be in the subset if we pick the first way. The second way might be to say, well, we want to make sure that we have adequate power in the subset because we're going to do the subset analysis if we have to at the 0.01 level of threat significance, and that's going to sort of cut into our power. On the other hand, we would expect a larger treatment effect in the subset. So I'm estimating that whatever the treatment effect, if the treatment effect is D up here, then the treatment effect for the subset should be sort of roughly D divided by the proportion positive. And so I will size the trial so I have adequate patients in that subset. And a third possibility might be size the trial as I described in one here, but if that is negative, then don't actually do the subset analysis immediately, but sort of continue accrual until you get a adequate sample size in your subset. Now you're sort of doing an enriched trial for that subset, and then so you know this is all sort of new stuff, and there's a variety. I'm sure there's many approaches that I'm not identifying here, but these are some considerations for way one might size the trial. And another kind of approach might be to say, well, okay, yeah, we won't restrict eligibility, but suppose what we really think is that we expect the drug to be effective in the subset, but we don't really expect it to be effective in classifier negative patients because of the mechanism of action of the drug, but we're going to include them in the trial anyway. So you might say in that situation, okay, well then, first thing we might do is compare the drug to control in the classifier positive patients. And if we don't get the significance for that at a traditional 0.05 level, then that's it. We don't do any more analysis. However, if we do get significance for the classifier positive patients at the 0.05 level, then we might look at the patients out, the classifier negative patients, or continue accrual for the classifier negative patients to be able to potentially detect a smaller treatment effect in the classifier negative patients. So this would be sort of the situation where you really think that the most likely situation is you're going to get you think that early on you can demonstrate the drug's going to be effective in the subset, and so you want to potentially get approval of the drug for the subset and then continue your trial for the negative patients to potentially detect a smaller treatment effect in the classifier negative patients. And I think I'll skip this detail of sample size planning for that approach. So the general idea again is to develop a completely specified classifier and then to establish an assay and reproducibility of that classifier. And that number two can itself be a substantial amount of work. You know, once you may be originally do the thing with regard to expression profiling, but want to have an assay that involves some platform which is more practical for clinical use than transcript expression profiling. And then finally use that completely specified classifier to structure an analysis of a randomized clinical trial. And the guiding principle being that the data used to develop the classifier must be distinct from the data used to test hypotheses about treatment selection in subsets determined by the classifier. It seems almost, you could say, well, that this is sort of obvious. But actually, most practice sort of violates this guiding principle. So the idea is that developmental studies are exploratory. That's great. You want to be exploratory. You want to be able to put into your classifier biological knowledge. But studies in which treatment effectiveness claims are to be based should not be exploratory. They should be sort of traditional hypothesis testing studies, but potentially that incorporate predefined subset analysis with experiment-wise error preserved. Now, I think in the future, probably more and more, as we develop really specific molecularly targeted treatments, the classifiers won't be real complicated multi-gene expression-based classifiers. They'll be single gene or protein, biomarkers based on knowledge of the therapeutic target. And but in some cases, for example, with drugs that are supposed to inhibit epidermoid growth factor receptor constitutive activation, there may be a variety of ways in which you might measure whether a tumor is being driven by a mutated EGFR gene or an amplified EGFR gene, and it may not be clear as to what the best kind of way of measuring it is. And so you may have either a number of candidate ways of measuring something or a number of candidate genes in terms of whose expression you want to measure. And so during a developmental phase, you'll have to focus on which of those candidate is sort of the best for giving a predictive classifier. And I think that will probably be a very common situation. And thirdly, where you have a drug that's so its activity is so nonspecific, like traditional drugs, that you really don't know what to measure, and so you'll sort of have to empirically do things like expression profiling to try to let the data tell you what are the informative genes and to develop classifiers. We're saying, well, how are you going to separate the development of a classifier from the use of a classifier? Well, you develop a classifier either during this phase 2 development or after a failed phase 3 trial in which you are fortunate enough to have archived specimens. Or we published one paper, Boris Friedland and I, about an adaptive use adaptive clinical trial design in which you both try to develop the classifier and potentially use it. I'll describe that, I think, the next slide. But we have some other, for expression-based classifiers, for gene expression-based classifiers, where you're measuring expression of tens of thousands of genes and trying to predict which patients respond and which don't respond to a given therapy. Recent paper of Kevin Dobbins and mine, preprint of which is both on the website and on the biostatistics website, suggests that it takes about 20 to 30 responders and equal or number or greater number of non-responders to really develop a predictive classifier. It doesn't take thousands of samples, as some have said, but at least for the reasons that we give in this very detailed paper, we think it takes about 20 to 30 responders, an equal number of non-responders. Of course, there is the problem with the classifier you develop in phase 2 that reflects response to your drug may not actually reflect differential response to your drug versus the control, or differential benefit with regard to disease-free survival. This is the citation, and the reprint is on the website, of this adaptive signature design that we developed. And I'll just have to sort of describe it very briefly. At the end of the trial, you compare your new treatment to your control for all patients at a significance level of threshold of 0.04. If you reject that null, then you claim effectiveness overall. Otherwise, you do two things. Using the first half of the patients entered into the trial, you develop a binary classifier of the patients who seem to benefit from the new treatment relative to the control. And I won't go into the details that are described in the paper of one way of developing that classifier. It involves selecting genes based on univariate interactions between outcome and treatment indicator, and then using sort of a voting classifier based on those selected genes. But you develop a binary classifier using the first half of the patients, and then you use the second half of the patients to do a subset analysis of the new treatment versus control for the classifier positive patients who came in the second half of the trial. So in this way, you try to still separate out, keep separate the development of the classifier from the use of the classifier, albeit all of the data now is developed in one pivotal trial. Of course, since you're using this one trial to do both things, and since you can only evaluate if you have to do the subset analysis in this subset, you're doing it at a reduced significance level, and you're only using half the patients or something like that, you're not going to have a whole lot of patients. So you're either going to have a whopping treatment effect in that subset, or you're going to need more patients for that subset. So probably it would be beneficial if you get to that point would be to continue accrual in that subset until you have enough patients to do that second analysis. I'll just skip over some of this stuff. Thought I would spend, we have a little bit of time, and so I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about myths about the development of predictive classifiers. Right now I've been talking about the use of predictive classifiers, and I haven't said very much about development, except that you're really better off if you can use classifiers related to the mechanism of action of the drug rather than sort of black box gene expression based classifiers. But I want to sort of talk a little bit about the development of gene expression based classifiers. I think one myth is that microarray studies are exploratory with no hypotheses or objectives, and you just sort of do data mining of available. So I feel, I'd like to point out good microarray studies, I think, have clear objectives. It's just that they're not gene-specific objectives, since you don't have to, previously you had to have an assay for every gene or every protein you wanted to look at. Now you have assays like gene expression microarrays that permit you to look at all of the genes, but you still have to have clear what you're trying to achieve. And so I try to distinguish class comparison, that is gene finding. Class comparison I think of as gene finding. You want to find genes whose expression differs from tumor versus normal, or high grade versus low grade, something like that, or pre-treatment versus post-treatment. And that's a different objective than class prediction, where you want to predict the patient, be able to predict whether a patient will have a response to a given treatment. Now, gene selection may be part of developing a good predictor, but it's not the objective. The objective is prediction. And so it's important to make that distinction, because the criteria for controlling multiplicity in class comparison problems where your objective is gene finding are very different than your criteria for how stringent you are in gene selection when your objective is prediction. Because in prediction problems, what's important is predictive accuracy. And so your stringency for gene selection should be calibrated to get the best predictive accuracy, not to achieve some arbitrary false discovery rate. And the third kind of objective is class discovery, where there's nothing like tumor versus normal or grade high grade versus low grade. There's no external classification involved. It's just sort of looking at a bunch of expression profiles and saying, are these all over the map, or are these all similar, or are there clusters? Finite number of clusters, they fall into a finite number of clusters, or similarly for the expression profiles of genes across a set of samples. And I won't talk anything about class discovery, except I think it's a myth that cluster analysis is generally useful. Some people think of microarray analysis as cluster analysis. But for class comparison and class prediction, where you have these classes, however they're defined, these are really not clustering problems at all, and for the most part, you would be better off not using cluster analysis in any form. And really for these, I feel that these are supervised methods in which you utilize your class definitions, whatever they are, in the analysis of the data. I think some statisticians are very cynical, very of expression analysis of microarray data. They sort of feel like development of good predictive classifiers when you have thousands of genes in 100 cases or less is basically just not possible. And sort of all of these publications dealing with that are really just sort of misleading. And I think that that's not true. I think it's just that our conventional wisdom is developed based on problems of inference rather than problems of prediction, and our methods have been developed for problems where the number of variables is smaller than the number of cases, and so our usual methods don't work well in these situations, but there are other methods that do work well if we are clear about what we mean working well. In other words, we can't identify what the right model is when we have thousands of variables and 100 or fewer cases. However, we can actually, in many cases, develop models that predict accurately. We have to be able to distinguish. We may not be able to say what exactly are the right set of genes and be sure that we exclude most of the false positives. But if our objective is prediction, then we don't have to worry about doing that. What's important for prediction, it's much more serious for prediction to miss the inclusion of informative genes. That's much more serious than it is to include in your model noise genes. And so it's a harder problem to find what are exactly the right genes than to develop a model which predicts well. And so some of our, like I say, our conventional wisdom were developed for inference involved, and a lot of times we don't even think about it because we've had so little experience with prediction problems. And another myth, I think, is that, well, prediction means if I analyze a different set of data and try to develop a model, I should come up with the same model. And that's wrong. That's not the proper measure of whether a model validates. Validates should, in a prediction sense, means if I develop a model with a certain set of data, and now I use that model for prediction with a different set of data, I want it to predict accurately. It's not an issue of where now if I develop another model with a different set of data, will I get the same model? That's not proper. And so there's been a lot of publications criticizing microarray analysis based on the fact that different groups have analyzed data and come up with models that don't have much overlap in terms of the genes involved. Well, that's not a proper criticism. As I say, demonstrating statistical significance of prognostic factors is not the same as demonstrating predictive accuracy. And I basically made these points already. I think I will skip this. This is just a citation of a recent paper in the New England Journal that showed different models developed for predicting outcome for early breast cancer. For the most part, they all predict accurately for independent data, even though the models themselves are very different in terms of the genes they contain. It's also a myth, I think, that complex classification algorithms, such as neural networks, perform better than simpler ones. And I think that myth persists because people are trying to get either their methods or their applied studies in the highest profile journals. There is not enough comparative studies, but the comparative studies, I think, generally indicate that simpler methods work as well or better with microarray problems, not because the simpler methods find the right model, but rather because they don't overfit the data. And there's not enough data with that many genes in those few cases to find the right model. One of the things I've done with my software, BRB Array Tools, is put in a lot of different classifiers so that you can analyze your data and just check all the boxes to get the results with all of the classifiers, including random forests and support vector machines and top-scoring pairs, and then see whether with proper cross-validation or bootstrap resampling and getting fair, you know, unbiased estimates of prediction accuracy, whether any of these methods do better than any other ones. And for the most part, they all do about the same. I think I will have to skip most of this details about developing the classifier. Just to point out that in evaluating a classifier, we can't use goodness of fit anymore as a criteria of whether a model does well, because it with so many variables that you can always have goodness of fit. I guess you could measure whether the goodness of fit is too good, but it is really not the statistical significance of prognostic factors, which is a thing either. You really need some kind of a split sample or cross-validation or bootstrap resampling method that separates the model development from the evaluation of prediction accuracy. And there's a variety of ways to do it. The simple split sample, where you take your data and you use some of your sample for developing your classifier and you measure its accuracy on the remainder of it, or there's leave one out cross-validation, which in a way is similar in spirit. You leave one sample out, you develop a model, completely specified classifier, and then you predict for the one that you left out, and then you count, did I get it? If you're just talking about binary outcome or binary class variable, did I get the prediction correct or not? And you redo that n times, leaving one of them out each time and then developing a new model. That's leave one out class cross-validation. And that's actually a very effective method for, particularly when you have not too many cases. But it's only valid if you redevelop your model from scratch. In other words, the error that's often made with cross-validation is people select genes using all the data and then cross-validate the model parameters in the cross-validation, thinking, well, how much difference can that matter, whether I leave one out and select my genes or use all? Well, it turns out it matters a lot, because all of the bias is in gene selection. And so if you use all of your data to select the genes, then there's no sense even bothering cross-validating, because your results are just totally biased. And doing any kind of cross-validation is just deceiving yourself and everybody else. We've done little simulations to sort of show that cross-validating after you use all the data to select the genes, in cases where the number of genes is much larger than the number of cases, is equivalent to essentially no cross-validation at all. There's also a myth that, well, split sample validation is in some sense superior to leave one out cross-validation or tenfold cross-validation. And I just refer you to Annette Molinaro's paper that in bioinformatics that shows that that's not the case. And looks at leave one out k-fold cross-validation and repeated k-fold cross-validation and a lot of and bootstrap resampling for estimating error rates, and compares these different methods. I think I just see if I have any final statements. We don't. I did want to emphasize there is a difference between any of these kind of internal methods of validation and external, we might call external validation, but I'll have to, there's no time to discuss that. There is a myth, like I say, that huge sample sizes are needed to develop effective predictive classifiers, and I won't have time to go through it, but Kevin Dobbin and I published a paper about sample size for gene finding problems, either class comparison or finding genes whose expression is correlated with outcome, with time to event outcome. And then we have this other paper that's in press in biostatistics on sample size planning for developing a predictive classifier, where gene finding is only one of the steps. And we show in that paper how your criteria, your stringency of gene selection is different there, depends on your sample size and how it affects predictive accuracy. And it's in this paper that the basis for my earlier statement that about 20 to 30 responders and 20 to 30 or more non-responders are needed for developing. When I say for developing, the way we did it was we said, well, if you had an infinite sample size, you had an infinite number of cases, you still wouldn't have a perfect classifier, just because these class, with regard to, say, gene expression variables, these classes may be, are probably overlapping. So even if you had the perfect model, that doesn't mean you're going to be able to classify cases perfectly accurately. So there is some probability of correct classification of infinity, that is how well you would do if you had an infinite number of cases. And what we take is the objective is sort of the expected value of the probability of correct classification with n cases should be within gamma of the best achievable with an infinite number of cases. And so we look at a gamma like of 0.05 or a gamma of 0.10 and to show how rapidly you approach that in terms of the number of cases required. And that kind of analysis was the and it's not a simulation analysis, it is a theoretical analysis. We had to make lots of simplifying assumptions, but we tried to make all of the assumptions in the form of, well, each simplifying assumption we tried to make in the direction that actually it should give us too large a sample size, because we assume we're using really dumb classifiers and things like that, and we assume that there's only one informative gene, things like that, and so the sample size you get using those kinds of simple assumptions, the assumptions make it tractable enough to actually get an answer. And the answer you get is surprisingly that you need fewer samples than you might have thought. And I think the reason is, if you have a gene that's not too differentially expressed, say between your responders and your non-responders, you will need a large sample size to find that kind of gene, particularly among the thousands of genes that exist. But there's no point in finding that gene, because that gene doesn't actually help you very much for prediction. So the only genes that really help you for prediction for individual cases are the genes that are more differentially expressed. And those genes don't take a huge sample size to find. And it is actually the gene finding which is the sort of rate-limiting step in the development of a classifier. Although we consider in the paper, we consider not just the gene finding, but also the rest of the problem. But anyway, that's my intuitive explanation of why you get by with a and I'll skip all of these details of sample size calculations, and I'll skip selected features of BRB array tools by software. And to the conclusions of new technology and biological knowledge, I think make it increasingly feasible to identify which patients are most likely to benefit from a particular treatment. and predictive medicine is feasible. It doesn't mean, I mean, sometimes we sort of laugh at personalized treatment, meaning that there's going to be a different recommended treatment for each patient based on the day of the month they were born and all of that kind of stuff. It doesn't mean that, but different, certainly for cancer, we're sort of almost already in the era of predictive medicine, where different treatments work for patients based on the biologic characteristics of their tumors, and we have now pretty powerful tools for measuring those biological characteristics on a genome-wide basis and for developing predictive classifiers that help us make those kind of predictions. And targeting treatment can greatly improve both the therapeutic ratio of benefit to adverse events, leading to smaller clinical trials and more greater proportion of the treated patients who actually benefit, and potentially important economic benefits for all of us. Achieving the potential of the new technology does require some paradigm changes in focus and methods of what we're used to in sort of correlative science, where we're correlating biologic measurements with treatment responses. And I think achieving potential of new technology in terms of really making effective treatments available for the right patients required some new kinds of partnerships among various segments, industry, academia, NIH, and FDA, because development of some of these things doesn't have the economic, the clear economic incentive necessary to get them done. And so, I think those that it was sort of incentive that sort of led to my first design. In other words, I thought, well, you could say, you get to test things overall for all randomized patients at a 0.04 level, and if that's significant, then you should get a broad approval. If it's not significant, then you do a subset analysis. Well, that's partly driven by the fact that if you don't put that first part of it in, then is a company really going to even want to play with predictive classifiers unless they have a situation where it's just totally obvious that you have to just treat the classifier-positive patients? Because if you don't permit that first part of that analysis plan, companies may just feel like there's too much risk to doing things. But that first part of it is sort of tuned to sort of incentives. And effective interdisciplinary research, I think, requires an increased emphasis on cross-education, both of the laboratory and clinical scientists and us as statisticians. Prospectively specified analysis plans are essential. Biomarker analysis doesn't mean exploratory analysis except for developmental studies. I think I want to mention some of my collaborators, including Annette Molinaro. And I've included just at the end here some relevant publications, just so if you do download the thing, you'll have those. Thank you very much.
Now those classifiers are perfect. So, I mean, the classifier itself is irrelevant in this data. So how do you come from that relevance in the summarized and the power calculation?
Well, for example, for the power calculation, for example, for the targeted trial, for example, where you in other words, where you're saying, well, maybe you're going to restrict. In other words, if you're going to restrict classifier positive patients, the relative efficiency of that was evaluated in the context where there's a certain treatment effect for classifier positives and a certain treatment effect for classifier negatives. And your classifier has a certain sensitivity and specificity for identifying both. So, in other words, if you wanted to assume that the sensitivity and specificity were both very low, you could do that, and you would see then, under those circumstances, there would be no efficiency gain. In fact, it would be a loss because, yeah. So, I think when you, in terms of any of these calculations, you have, they're based on assumptions about what the sensitivity and specificity of the assay are, and those are parameters you can just sort of put into these formula to do it. I mean, I think anyway, so to see what the situation is in those situations. I think you know anyway.
Yeah, my second question is, let's say you can use 50 genes that have prediction accuracy 80%. You can also use 500 genes with prediction accuracy 81%. If your classifier is based on this prediction only, you will end up with 500 genes. So there's slightly gain of prediction accuracy, but with a lot of more genes. So what I'm saying is your classifier, if it's based on prediction only, can be very unstable if you don't control for it for discovery.
What can be unstable?
This classifier. I mean,
what do you mean unstable?
You can use 500 genes.
Oh, in general, in all of these problems, the classifier is unstable. You have, it's just like an old regression problems. When you have correlated variables, you're...
Yeah, but if you use 50 genes, you have 500, it's much stable. I mean, more.
Well, stable. Even with 50, there's probably 500 sets of 50 genes. That will give you the same, pretty much the same prediction. So, yeah, there's an. Depending on your plat, what you'd ideally like is to have a very small number of genes, because that will make it easy to switch to a different platform that can, you know, based on a small number of genes. That also makes it easier to interpret your results. So I think when I was emphasizing it should only be based on predictive accuracy, I didn't mean. You know, that you couldn't, you know, also give consideration to the number of genes. I just meant it shouldn't, its predictive accuracy and other consideration, other practical considerations about developing an assay. I think, however, in general, there's lots of, in general, I mean, in exceptional circumstances, there could be a couple of genes that are very differentially expressed and give really great prediction. And in those circumstances, yes, you would like to come up with a model that has those genes in it. I think there's probably lots of other situations where that's not the state of nature. The state of nature is that there's a bunch of genes that are moderately differentially expressed, say, between those with good outcome and those with bad outcome. And if you try to select only the genes that are the most, seem to be the most differentially expressed in some training set, you'll select the wrong genes. You'll just select the, you know, the nth order statistics of the noise genes. And so you'll actually wind up with poor prediction when you use a, you know, test set or proper cross-validation. And you're better off in that situation if instead of that you just take a classifier that has more genes in it, then you'll probably get better prediction. Yeah, I agree with you, though, in the situation where if you've studied, you know, during this sort of developmental phase and you can see that, I would agree with you in the situation, you know, in the example you gave, you probably would much rather have the situation with a smaller number of genes in which the classification accuracy is about the same.
You mentioned that you could develop a good classifier with 20 to 30 responders, and what do you mean by responders?
Okay, well, first of all, let me clarify. Okay, well, what I meant was, when we did this second sample size paper that's sort of in press, we looked at just a binary situation. So two-class situation. And the classes can be whatever you want. So In other words, it could be response as defined, however it's appropriate to define it for your disease area, versus non-response. And so what I was trying to say, it's not really that you can always develop a good classifier with 20 or 30 responders. I probably said that, and it's not really the situation. What probably is more accurate to say, if you can't develop it with 20 or 30 responders and an equal number of non-responders, then you probably need thousands. And so it's not a situation where you're actually going to develop a good classifier. And so there's no actual point in going beyond that.
Yeah, I'm asking because there are many new target therapies in development, and many of these are mostly cytostatic drugs in cancer patients.
Well, in that kind of a situation, in other words, if you have some, suppose you have some unvalidated biomarker of the effect of your treatment on tumor growth, or suppose you, it would be the same, in that kind of a situation, what you might do is say, suppose you have time to progression, and you can do the same kind of thing, developing a classifier for risk group time to progression, those patients who have high risk for early time to progression versus low risk.
The classifier then would be prognostic.
Yeah, that would be a more difficult situation because the problem with time to progression is you can't necessarily assume that it has anything to do with your drug. So you're right, that's a more difficult situation. And,
yeah. I have a question about your earlier work. As you mentioned earlier in your presentation, since Simon's two-stage design was proposed, it was quite popular in practice. But sometimes you still see people use Gehan's two-stage design. I just wonder if you can give some suggestions in what kind of scenarios or which design would be more suitable. Or Simon's design is superior to Gehan's two-stage design in general.
The thing about Guillen's two-stage design, it was sort of in the first stage, if you see no responses in a certain number of patients, then you stop and declare the drug inactive. Otherwise, you go to some second stage that permits you to estimate your response rate with a given precision. And I think that's a perfectly fine design. I guess for me, I saw a lot of people thought of the Guillen design as being a one-stage design, and they were designing all their trials with 14 patients, and that's not really what Guillen had intended. And the other thing is, I have no criticism of the Guillen design. I think there was how I got to my design really was from Tom Fleming's design, where he had essentially a two-stage or a K-stage design, but the user had to specify how many stages and what should the size of each stage be. And sort of my way of thinking is, well, why should the user specify what the size of each stage should be? What the user should care about is what represents, a good response, what resembles a bad response, and what are the error rates. The rest of them are just design parameters that should be optimized over. And so, it seemed to me that, although Tom Fleming is a good friend of mine, it seemed to me that that kind of thing represented a confusion between what the consumer, what the user should have to specify and not. And so basically all I did was took the ideas that Tom had developed and others had developed in K-State designs before him, and just sort of tried to separate out into what were the parameters of that users should have to care about, and what were the rest of the parameters, and then I basically just optimized over the rest of the parameters.